Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. Bill was one of my best friends in Bible college. We were two young men from rural Maine who lived in the big city of Philadelphia. We rode together for our very first trip to Bible college. Bill came from the wrong side of the tracks, literally. His father was disabled, and the family lived in poverty. But Bill was a hard worker. He worked long hours and carried a full-time load at school. He was bright and did well academically. Many times I would walk down to his room in the dorm at midnight as I was done studying, and he was just beginning after his shift as a security guard. We prayed together, we studied together, and enjoyed college rap sessions together. During our junior year in college, Bill began to change. He became obsessed with reading all the works of the atheist Friedrich Nietzsche, first as a project for our history class, and later out of interest in his writings. We talked often about atheism, philosophy, and the injustices of life. That year, Bill's fiancée broke up with him. He was devastated. She broke up with him because her parents wanted her to break off the relationship. Her parents were Christians from the same church Bill attended, yet they didn't want their daughter to marry someone from across the tracks. Bill became bitter and angry with God and the church. Oh, how he prayed for God to do something about it. But nothing happened. Then, a college professor lied to both of us about a project that Bill and I had done and gave us both a bad grade as a result. Bill stood in my room as I packed to go home. He was angry and bitter about Christians and about God. I was getting married in a week and so had big plans, but Bill's world had fallen apart, and this was the last straw. He never came back to Bible college for his senior year. He withdrew. He became sexually involved with a young girl that summer, and she got pregnant. I lost touch with him for several years, but went to see him again at the university where he was studying history and philosophy. Bill had become an atheist. His is an atheism born out of deep disappointment with God and the church. He feels betrayed by God. He would say, "God never proved himself to me when I needed him the most." I think there are two kinds of faith in this world. Prove it to me, faith, and sticking with it, faith. Prove it to me, faith believes in God as long as God pays our bills for us, or solves our problems, or meets our needs. Sticking with it, faith is the kind of faith we have when we ask God to pay the bills or meet our needs, and he doesn't. When we face deep suffering, when we experience great loss, when we undergo injustice and pain, the only thing that can get us through is sticking with it, faith. Real faith is persevering faith, sticking with it faith. A suffering faith is a persevering faith. What do you do when you cry out to God and He doesn't answer? You stick with it anyway. There are four characteristics of sticking with it faith, of persevering faith in James 5, verses 7 through 12. First, a persevering faith is patient, verses 7 and 8. James writes, "Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and late rains. You too be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near." I'm sure that you've heard the expression that whenever you see a therefore in the Bible, you should ask, what is the therefore therefore? James has been speaking about how the wealthy in our world oppress and exploit the poor in verses 1 through 6. He tells us in these verses that God will judge the rich one day for their sins of oppression and exploitation. But what should Christians who are being exploited do in the meantime, until God acts? When the wealthy bring pain and suffering on us, how should we respond? God tells us we should respond with patience. Patience. I know that when we are experiencing injustice, the last piece of advice we want to hear is to be patient. However, three times in these verses, James uses the verb to be patient. The word literally means to be long-tempered as opposed to short-tempered. Patience is not passive resignation. It is active self-restraint. Do not retaliate against those who are oppressing you, but be patient, realizing that the Lord will deal with the problem in His time. Twice, James speaks of the coming of the Lord in these verses. This term for coming was commonly used in the first century for the visit of a king to a city or a district. The great hope of the Christian is for the return of the Lord, and Jesus could come at any time. James tells us to strengthen our hearts with the hope of His coming. Don't let anyone take that hope away from you. The hope of His coming will see you through the darkest nights and toughest times. We are to wait for the Lord, like the farmer waits for the early and late rains. In Palestine, the winter rains were heaviest from December through February. However, the early rains began in late October or early November. These rains would help the seeds germinate before the heavy rains arrived. The late rains came in April and May. These light rains were necessary for the crop to ripen. The farmer knows the meaning of patience because he must wait for the rains to produce his crop. In the same way, we must wait for the coming of the Lord to set things right in His time. It's not the length of the wait that matters. It is how you handle the wait that counts with God. So first, a persevering faith is patient. Second, a persevering faith is uncomplaining in verse 9. Do not complain, James says. Do not complain, brethren, against one another, so that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door. The word translated as complain means to groan or sigh. The mumbly grumblies are a real problem for all of us when we're hurting. When things go sour, our first reaction is to grumble about our circumstances and our second is to blame other people. After all, our problem surely couldn't be our fault. The New English Bible translates the verse, "My brothers, do not blame your troubles on one another, or you will fall under judgment. And there stands the judge at the door." The mumbly grumblies is the most infectious disease I know. It only takes a few people in a church who begin to complain and grumble, and before you know it, they infect the whole church with their negative attitude. Negativity spreads like COVID. The children of Israel are great examples of the mumbly grumblies. What a bunch of whiners. They complained about the water. They complained about the food. They complained about the heat. And they complained about their leaders. They complained about the dirt. And then, when they had a chance to enter the promised land, they complained about the giants. No wonder God banished them to the wilderness for 40 years. God wasn't about to bless that bunch of whining wimps with anything. But are we so different, my friends? How often do we complain about our lives and our circumstances, our situations? Look, we in the United States have it better than most people in this world, and yet we complain more than they do. Complaining is a symptom of unbelief. We don't trust God. We don't believe He can take care of us. My friends, faith does not complain. Faith does not blame. Faith perseveres. Faith sticks with it. The first characteristic of persevering faith is that it is patient. The second mark of a persevering faith is that it is uncomplaining. Now we come to the third characteristic of a persevering faith in verses 10 and 11. A persevering faith is enduring. It is enduring, verses 10 and 11. As an example, brethren, of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. We count those blessed who endured. You have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. James introduces two new words to describe a persevering faith. He speaks of the ability to suffer hardships. If you look down to verse 13, he uses the same word to say, "Is anyone among you suffering?" To endure hardship and evil, but still trust God, is a mark of persevering faith. The word translated endure means to hold out, to stand firm, or to put up with our tough circumstances. There is a constancy to faith. There is a consistency to faith that remains under the sufferings as we trust God for the outcome. James follows up his words about endurance by giving us two great illustrations or examples of endurance. He uses the example of the prophets, like, for example, Jeremiah, and the example of the patriarch, Job. So let's learn from these examples. First of all, the endurance of Jeremiah. One of my favorite prophets is Jeremiah. God called Jeremiah to be a prophet before he was even born. God commissioned Jeremiah to speak words of doom and gloom, and he warned Jeremiah that the people would hate and attack him for his message. He would not win any popularity contests. What a great job description. Jeremiah tells God, "Sorry, but I don't want this job. Give it to someone else. There's no job security here, no success plan here." But God replies, "No, the job is yours, Jeremiah. Do it." Jeremiah the prophet served through the reigns of five kings, but the last four kings hated him. The last king was Zedekiah. Zedekiah would ask Jeremiah for a word from the Lord, and Jeremiah would say, "The Babylonians are going to wipe you out." Zedekiah would say, "Throw him in the pit." Later, Zedekiah would call him back and ask, "What's the word from the Lord now?" And Jeremiah would say, "Oh, no, not again." But he would say, "The Babylonians are going to wipe you out. Back into the pit." Jeremiah tries to resign from his job. He tells God, "I don't want this job anymore, but every time I try to be quiet, your words are like a volcanic fire rising up in my soul. I have no choice, God. I have to speak your word. I have to be faithful." When the Babylonians came to destroy Jerusalem, a remnant from Israel escaped and took Jeremiah with them to Egypt. He died in Egypt, far from his home, still faithfully preaching God's word and shepherding God's people. Jeremiah stuck it out. He had a faith that endured to the end. Now look at the endurance of Job. We all know about Job. In the perspective of Philip Yancey, Job was a victim of a gigantic wager, a cosmic bet between God and Satan. The bet was that Job would be faithful even if God allowed Satan to take away everything from Job except his life. Talk about life throwing you an unfair curveball. You can't get more unfair than being the victim of a bet. And Job was not quiet about it either. He screamed at God and his friends. He demanded that God tell him what was going on. In the end, God simply says to him, "Look, Job, when you can create and sustain the universe, then I'll answer you, Job. Until then, fall on your knees before me, for I am God." And Job does. He falls on his face to worship God. Even in all of his struggles, Job never denied God. His faith endured to the end. He stuck it out, and God blesses him for it. There's an anonymous poem that expresses this thought well. Two frogs fell into a deep cream bowl. One was an optimistic soul, but the other took the gloomy view. "We shall drown," he said, without more ado. So with a last despairing cry, he flung out his legs and he said goodbye. Quote the other frog with a merry grin, "I can't get out, but I won't give in. I will just swim around till my strength is spent, and then I will die the more content." Bravely he swam till it would seem his struggles began to churn the cream. On top of the butter he gladly stopped, and out of the bowl he gaily hopped. What is the moral? It is easily found. If you can't hop out, keep swimming around. Notice James 5:11 tells us that the Lord is compassionate and merciful. God is interested in the outcome, in the result, not the experience itself. In the end, persevering faith learns that God is full of compassion and mercy. The result is always good with God. We may not think so while we're swimming around, but God listens and God answers. Listen very carefully to what I am about to say. There is a spiritual principle drawn from the lives of the Old Testament men and women of faith. And the principle is this: the closer you walk with God, the more he may hurt you, because it is only through the pain that God produces endurance. That's a hard lesson to learn. There is no other way to produce endurance. Endurance is learned only through pain, only through struggle. It's a hard lesson, but a persevering faith is an enduring faith. It endures no matter what God throws in our path. And finally, a persevering faith is honest, verse 12. It is honest. James ends this paragraph in verse 12 with these words. But above all, my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath. But your yes is to be yes and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment. At first glance, this verse doesn't seem to connect with the theme of faith, persevering under the pressure of suffering. However, the people to whom James is writing were living under the heavy hand of their rich land barons, the owners of the properties. They might have been trying to convince their wealthy oppressors by swearing an oath to them, an oath of allegiance. If they could swear allegiance to the boss, then they could get better terms for their labor, and they could be more successful. Swearing an oath in this context refers to the common practice of supporting or backing up our promises by appealing to God. It was a common practice among the Jews. In the Mishnah, which is the collection of Jewish religious regulations, there's a whole tractate, a whole section devoted to oath-taking. In fact, the Jews distinguished between binding oath and non-binding oaths. If you swore by Shaddai or Sebaoth, you were bound to fulfill your oath. But if you swore by heaven or earth, you were not bound to fulfill your oath. It would be sort of like our practice of saying, cross my heart, hope to die, while having our fingers crossed behind our backs. It's the art of lying while pretending to tell the truth with an oath. By heaven or by earth, James says. Why do you feel the need to use oaths anyway? Sometimes there's a fear that no one will believe us. In the case of the rich land barons, these wealthy bosses, the poor were desperate to get favorable terms for themselves, so they took impressive oaths. They tried to impress their bosses with these promises sworn under the power of God or heaven or earth. Sometimes we exaggerate and try to give credibility to our exaggerations with an oath. The best way to avoid swearing is not to exaggerate, James says, but to carefully tell the truth and then stand behind our statements, stand behind our yeses and our noes. Some Christians have argued that this verse prohibits taking an oath even in a court of law. I can understand that belief, but I doubt if James was specifically thinking about courtrooms here. The point James is making is that we should not utter careless or frivolous oaths. As someone has said, don't use the name of the Lord promiscuously. Let your word stand for itself. Be trustworthy. And a persevering faith is honest. People can trust what we say. We don't have to resort to oaths. This kind of faith illustrates the old-fashioned word integrity. What kind of faith do you have? Do you have a prove-it-to-me faith or a stick-with-it faith? Pain, loss, grief, betrayal, and injustice, those will test your faith, my friends. Will your faith stand the test of time or wither in the face of adversity? A suffering faith requires a persevering faith. A persevering faith is the only faith that will get you through the tough times when God seems distant and silent. W.A. Criswell, the longtime pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, enjoyed telling the story about an evangelist who had two Irish setters in his backyard, his prize dogs. One day, an ornery old bulldog came along and squeezed under the fence to get at his prize Irish setters. The evangelist was about to go out when he decided to let his dogs give that little bulldog a whipping, which they proceeded to do. The little bulldog finally had enough and slinked out of the yard. The next day, the little bulldog was back to pick a fight again. Once again, the setters gave him a whipping, and he left the yard battered and bruised. But the next day, the bulldog was back again. And the next day, and the next. It was the same story and the same ending. Rinse and repeat. The evangelist had to leave for several weeks, and when he came back, he asked his wife what had happened. She said, "You won't believe it. Every day at the same time, that little bulldog came back to fight. He never missed a day. It has come to the point where our setters only have to hear him snorting down the alley or see him coming under the fence, and they whine and run into the basement. That little bulldog struts around our backyard now like he owns it." That's perseverance, my friends. We need more bulldog Christians and fewer setter Christians in our churches today.